Hi, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of Silent Generation. You just heard the song Residence by Home, which we're going to talk a lot about in this week's episode, throughout the episode, because we're going to be talking Vaporwave. And thankfully, we have a guest with us, Droom, who is actually a longtime friend of mine. And you used to have a Vaporwave music project called 11 Eastern, right?
That is correct.
Cool. And now you primarily make which genre of music?
So the Droom project is primarily a techno project. I would say that the productions I'm most associated with as Droom are more between tribal techno and industrial techno.
Cool. And so one thing that I've been told by people, because I've known Peter for a while, is that we kind of have the same voice.
I'm seeing that now. I was just thinking of it as you said it there. Yeah, I see a lot of similarities.
Yeah, we had this friend who used to say that he seems like my little brother, which syncs up in a few ways. You're a year younger than me. But the way we actually met is kind of random. So you're also someone that I met through the infamous Facebook group, Gay North Shore Teens, the GNST.
Yes.
We had another guest from that group.
Yeah, we just keep on drawing from that pool.
Who was the other guest?
Cone Ranger, Cone.
Cone?
Conrad?
He wasn't that like much of a poster. I don't think he posted at all.
Conrad.
But, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it maybe sounds familiar.
Yeah, he joined us for our Cowboys episode. And
so
that was how we initially met. And then I think I noticed that you had like aesthetic-esque pictures as your profile pics.
Maybe. I think the first interaction I remember us having was, I think I might have posted about like Paris is burning, and you commented.
Oh, you loved
like,
that. You that was big for you.
Yeah.
It
like,
was.
I love this documentary.
Yeah, no, I actually had like I had one or two Paris is burning cover photos on my Facebook, but it became like so like popular with people that like I think are annoying that I don't really like to.
You know, disowned your fascination.
I don't associate with it as much.
Yeah.
Because there was this really, it seems actually really good, but like I just can't bring myself to watch it. There was this show called Pose, which was sort of based off of Paris is Burning. Yeah, Vogue culture is actually really awesome, but yeah, that was the first thing you saw me post, or that was our first interaction
right
through the GNSC. And then I think you realized I was into C-Punk and I realized you were into Vaporwave. And
yeah, I think that's how it went.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you were actually on Tumblr, whereas I never was, because I made the mistake of always thinking that it was going to go out of style, and it never
did.
Yeah, everything does, but you can still, you know, have fun in the last gasp.
Well, I don't know. I think that in 2018, when they got rid of all the adult content, I think it was like a death knell for Tumblr, and a lot of people stopped using it. They just moved to Twitter and OnlyFans, so...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But there were always like multiple spheres.
That's
on
true.
And Tumblr is like majority Filipino. It's the one thing people don't really realize, like user base wise. Yeah, it's huge in the Philippines. But yeah, it's these all like self sort and kind of like silo themselves, basically. Where if you're on one side of Tumblr, you're not going to see the other one.
Yeah.
That's true. I mean, a lot of the more like aesthetic blogging or the more, you know, like cool visuals that you're just posting because they look cool, it's still there, but I don't feel like it's what it used to be. I don't feel like there's as much like momentum behind it. I don't think it's kind of still like attached to trends that are going on right now in like fashion, design, whatever. But, you know, kind of in place of like health goth and like Y2K, you know, posts about like that fashion and that look. I know that it's kind of become more just from friends that still use the website. It's more like post Y2K, but like in a more distressed and like earthy kind of.
Like people are not doing like technology focused
like
posting.
Granola
it's more
daughter.
Like.
It's almost like you're like a combination of like a crunchy granola hippie
yeah.
and like someone who wears like distressed jeans, affliction shirts.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Wait, this is making me think of Cheaper by the Dozen, The Boy Who Liked Frogs.
I never saw that movie.
Okay.
So I'm...
How is this reminding you of that? You got to draw that line for me.
Okay, just... I feel like this is giving Montessori child...
Montessori child vibes.
Or just like, you're into nature, earthy, right?
Well, what I meant by that is more like just like the color palette.
Oh, okay.
Like a lot of like khaki green, a lot of maybe taupe and like ivory, but it's all, everything looks kind of dirty and distressed. I haven't really seen too many guys like wearing this stuff, but like the more girls and like femme people, whatever, when they wear it, it's more like very skimpy. Like I'm wearing like a G-string made of dental floss.
So the horny posting is still there on Tumblr. It's just had to get a little smarter because anything like actually 18 and up content is.
Yeah. But fun. I think that's even starting to come back. I don't know. It's just that like people have kind of like made their new home like Twitter.
Yeah. I don't know. I always kind of thought that there were legs to the Tumblr format. I thought that like the site itself and it had all these things attached to it that I think were a detriment to it. Like maybe the pornography and stuff like that, but also the perception that it was for kids and young people. I think the format of just like no text limits, like videos, photos, and everything, it just seems the most all-encompassing thing. I was kind of surprised when, I don't know, that everything, I guess Twitter was just the final like text-based / photo and video-based like scrolling system.
I think Instagram also shadowed it because I think a lot of people are finding, you know, like fashion and art and very visual media through Instagram rather than like Tumblr. I think Instagram has just kind of like broadened its functionality to the point where it kind of eclipsed what Tumblr was doing.
Because Tumblr, at least in the time I was there, I'm sure they changed later, but it didn't seem very algorithm heavy. Like there wouldn't be suggested posts, right?
No.
It would just be who you follow. But then the people you follow would reblog from something from somewhere else.
Yeah.
Like it was much, less algorithmic as the Instagram Explore page, which I refuse to click.
Yeah.
The Instagram Explore page scares me. There's just all these things. It's
I think
just
it
like,
says things about you. Like when I show you mine.
It's kind of like a,
it holds a mirror up to me. I don't want to look in the mirror. I don't want to see that.
Yeah. So did you find Vaporwave through Tumblr or how did you initially find it?
You know, my introduction to Vaporwave was not directly to Vaporwave. It was a bit more oblique. What I became familiar with first were these musical genres that are adjacent to it called Chillwave and Synthwave, which are also kind of concerned sonically, aesthetically with a lot of 80s music, the retro vibe. And I became acquainted with these genres after going to the Apple store in mid-2011 because I had been using the software Logic Pro or just Logic at that time for maybe a couple years. And I was comfortable with it, but I wanted to do some more, you know, learn some more advanced functionality with it. And so I just set up a Genius Bar appointment and this guy was like helping me, you know, just teaching me some more advanced things about Logic. He, at the end of the lesson, we were listening to something I had made, I was making trance music at the time. And
at what age?
I must have been 13.
Wow.
Maybe 14.
You're a very gay baby.
Yeah, I mean,
making trance music before graduating middle school.
Exactly. No, I mean, I was such a trance head, such a trance addict, starting in sixth grade until I started high school when, I went to this Apple store. This guy told me, he's like, you should check out this musician, Calm Trues. I would say he's more synthwave. He's very synthwave. He kind of, I wouldn't say he started the genre.
I think anytime a music genre looks backwards like that, it's out of extreme dissatisfaction with the present day. And so the present day of electronic dance music of that era, I remember it too. I was not a fan of it then. I really looked down on EDM and stuff back then, but it was, I mean, nothing against Avicii, but
it was
a little bit against Avicii.
See, the thing is around 2011, this is when dubstep, the banga scream, type of dubstep where that was actually very cool and underground in the UK in 2004. It was and then, Skrillex just kind of, blew that into overdrive. He really put it on crack. And, that just, took off in the United States. And it was very, a kind of, frat bro. But also, kind of, trailing off of emo at the same time. It was
because Skrillex was from,
anomalous phenomenon.
Skrillex was in a band. I always hate using the term screamo because I feel like people will come out and wag fingers and stuff because there's all these different subgenres and stuff. But he used to be a front man and he would scream and he threw out his vocal cords basically. And that's how he got into like producing.
Oh, music.
It's his villain origin story. Yeah.
That's cool. Like, I didn't know, like, he injured himself and then had to make dubstep.
Was forced to make dubstep.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, so you found Vaporwave through the Apple Genius Bar. And then how did 11 Eastern come to be?
So I was making trance music up until that point, and it kind of affected trance music too, this EDM boom. It like, instead of being like very like concerned with being beautiful and like super melodic, harmonic, trance music became like a really bad caricature of like Avicii and Swedish House Mafia. And I became really disillusioned with that. So when I heard about like Comtruz, I looked it up on iTunes and I just kind of, you know, like in iTunes, like suggested, like listeners also bought, like I was coming across these artists like Washed Out, LA Vampires, Atra Nuvu, these people that were making some really weirdo music that was like 80s sounding in a vague way. And it kind of like inspired me to like make that instead of trance. And so for the next couple of years, I was kind of like honing in on that sound. And then in like the end of 2012, beginning of 2013, I put together this Tumblr called 11 Eastern. And
which still exists, and we're going to put it in the notes for this week's episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like I made that Tumblr kind of thinking that it would be like a way to kind of promote my music by like I would post like, I would reblog like just stuff that I thought was like cool looking, but also
a lot of 80s still lives.
Yeah, I mean, if you like went back through the archives of the blog to like the very beginning, it was, you know, kind of corny, kind of like not quite at the level of like Cat on Pizza, but in space, but it was kind of like almost like,
yeah, like the next step after the Lol So Random type of internet.
Yeah,
content.
It was a lot of like, you know, like Patrick Nagel, like nail salon poster looking things. And then I don't know.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, looking at, I can scroll back decently far before Tumblr stops me and it tries to make me like make an account, and I'm like, I am not gonna either rediscover my old login for Tumblr from like 2013 or make a Tumblr account in 2024. Like, I'm not gonna do either of those. But yeah, you start off very like, you know, hyper colored 80s kind of thing, and then it kind of comes in this more like somber, like neutral tones, gray tones, like metal furniture, red accents, like a very luxe 80s type of
more
Patrick
mature,
Bateman
more
apartment
adult
kind of stuff.
I would say so. I mean, the thing about that Tumblr is it wasn't really taking off. Like, it only had a couple hundred followers. And at a certain point, I wasn't even really using it or thinking of it as a promotional tool for my music. I was thinking it more like it was
standalone project.
Yeah, like not even like an archive, more like a game of solitaire that I played on my own, like visual solitaire.
Like, does this fit the pattern here? Like, does this have an element that fits with the previous like photos, basically?
Are you asking if it was always solitaire or if it was like, or?
I'm just like, it's like, it's, I think it comes from an urge to like, you know, to collect things and to like curate things together, but you're seeing it in a very kind of like gamified sort of way that like it has to fit into the puzzle.
It was kind of like an OCD, like, you know,
the process
like I have
itself
OCD,
was very,
but it was also just kind of like
you have actual OCD,
like clinical OCD. So it's like, it was kind of like an outgrowth of that, like an offshoot where it was like something I did to kind of like calm myself almost, or like made me feel like there is like a
order to things.
Like something I had some control over and like could feel satisfied with. And it was like the kind of process I went through with blogging and reblogging, posting was more like every month would have like, well, I would, you know, be scouring Tumblr for images and saving them to my likes, you know, like from month to month, because in the archive of a Tumblr blog, it's like split up by month. So I wanted it to be that each month would have its own look or like visual theme. And I would kind of go through my likes and post things that I thought related to the theme, or I would just notice like a trend in my likes. And I decided like, okay, like this is kind of the theme based on what I've gleaned from like looking around Tumblr. I'll just post these images that look similar or related all within 1 month. And then I'd try to, with the following month, post the next month's images in an order such that the previous month's the previous month when you're like scrolling on the actual like front page of the Tumblr, like it would just kind of seamlessly blend from one month to the one after it.
But that's why it looks so good. You put so much work into it.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I don't know, maybe not nowhere near the same level of like someone discovering like a closet of someone's like outsider art, like yeah. Yeah. or something. But it, I don't know. I feel like it's
you would be really bummed if it got taken down, right?
Maybe. I mean, I still like to.
You should
look
archive
at it.
Yeah. I archive a lot of my things. Mm-hmm. I have like a very large Google Drive collection of projects that I've worked on.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I know that like a lot of people were exporting their Tumblrs to WordPress, but WordPress does not have like the theme that the Tumblr websites did.
Oh yeah, where we could like, actually like change
like the special
background.
HTML
yeah.
like layout. So that would be lost.
But even the images are worth keeping and saving.
That's true.
Yeah, I don't really, I am a librarian. Me becoming one was not as like of a direct choice as people may think. It was like I got a job with a library and then the opportunity to get a master's was offered and I took it. It's not as much like I thought I fit the idea or the persona of a librarian as much. But one of the things that I think does synchronize is like I do have like an archival tendency. Like even as a child, I would collect like
keep
toys from the 90s
sort,
and 80s that like predated my childhood.
Oh, that's
I've always been interested in that kind of thing.
I used to actually collect like Lego sets from like the 60s and 70s.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Interesting.
There are a lot of nerds that want those and will pay you for them.
Yeah, I mean, that is true.
Do you have them?
Yeah, but they're kind of like I have them and I would just have to kind of reorganize them and
reconstruct them or like separate them. And
exactly.
Yeah.
I had a friend, like, so I was into Bionicles as a kid, you know, the like Lego, like action figure ones. And I bought one for my friend because we were both into them. And then he's like, nice, thanks so much. I'll put it up on my shelf. And I was like, oh, are you going to like open it and play with it? He's like, no, they're going to be worth so much in a few years. And I was like, right. He's right. But like, as a child, why do you care about investment? Like, why do you care about, and it was like artificial scarcity in like the resale market. But they do go for crazy amounts on eBay. I do check every so often, but I wouldn't trade that for the wonderful Bionicle experiences I had as a kid.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But yeah, we should get into Vaporwave, into the meat of things now. So next, we're going to be talking about the origins of Vaporwave. So Vaporwave has less traceable origins than C-Punk, it seems like. With C-Punk, there was like one person who very clearly coined the term, you know, little internet, and it started as a tweet. So for Vaporwave, it seems like the music came first and then later the aesthetic started to develop and then a term was coined Vaporwave through forums. But there are a couple of very influential musicians who like sort of started to get people to think about the 80s in different ways. And so the first one is Daniel Lopatin or 10 Tricks Point Never and Joel Ford of Tiger City. So you wrote in the docket that like they released the EP that we can play. And then later on, they released Chuck Person's Echo Gems Volume 2. And Echo Gems is really interesting to me because I didn't really realize before this episode that like Vaporwave music can be traced as a direct offshoot of C-Punk music through this album, right?
Well, I think that the Echo Gems came first. I think, you know, maybe the little internet was aware of Echo Gems and it may have been some sort of influence or impetus, but I think
it's both like C-Punk and Vaporwave, like because
it is the
Echo
one, like
the Dolphin,
inflection point. Yeah,
as a
it's
source,
like a synergy. Yeah,
because Echo the Dolphin as a source is a C-Punk. It's like a C-Punk video game essentially, and then the music itself was 80s, and so Echo Gems as a project, the aesthetics were C-Punk, but the music was starting to lean more Vaporwave and became an influential mixtape or album for Vaporwave musicians and later on.
Yeah, it started off as just kind of this thing, like an etude, like these series of etudes that Daniel Lopatin was working on with sampling, chopping and screwing, you know, slowing things down, processing them in a certain way. Yeah, I think what's even relevant to mention, in addition to Echo Gems, is the YouTube channel he was doing prior to it, like around the year 2008, 2009, called Memory Vague, where it was these kind of like screen or like screensaver type videos, you know, just a
like the THX logo type of vibes,
or like Orion, like that distribution,
interstitials, like kind of like production company,
Reading Rainbow, graphics. Like kind of, or even like video game, like you know, like 8-bit looking things,
like a all jingle with a visual, essentially.
Yeah, it was. So he would take like these slow down loops from other songs. It would go, the loop would go on for like a couple minutes, and there would just be like a looping video to go with it. These got kind of big on YouTube, and then 2009, the Memory Vague, these videos were released on a DVD called Memory Vague through the label that released the DVD. I forget the name of, but I'd say that was like the first kind of like real fleshed out, put together work of Vaporwave.
Oh.
Yeah, so that like definitely predates C-Punk, even Witch House probably, because I think Witch House was more like 2010, but
probably.
Yeah. And then the next musician you wrote about is James Ferraro. So apparently his like early solo musical work came to be associated with the 2000s through a genre called hypnagogic pop. But with the release of his EP Condo Pets and the album Farside Virtual, he started to make music in a novel sonic aesthetic. So could you talk about that a bit?
So when James Ferraro was putting together Condo Pets and Farside Virtual, his conceptualization, or like the conceptual framework for those releases, was on these are like a series of ringtones that like someone could put on their cell phone, and he made them with stock MIDI timbres. So like MIDI is like on...
What is a timbre?
A timbre is... It's hard to explain, but it basically means like the type of sound or like the perceived origin of a sound, like a piano sound versus a guitar sound, like piano, guitar, different timbres.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is making me think of Foley, how like in movies, you know, they'll crush red peppers instead of like, you know, that will get the sound of a breaking bone.
Right.
Yeah.
And so a timbre is like more authentic to its original sound.
Well, I just use the term like MIDI timbres because like MIDI is not only like a signal or a code that like allows musical instruments and sequencers to kind of send patterns and data back and forth. It also come like the MIDI protocol came with like these like samples of like, you know, like piano sounds, guitar, different instruments.
They're just very like elemental.
Even drum sounds. They're like these very...
They're very stock, basic, stock, like...
Generic kind of sounds that...
It's like an electronic keyboard.
Exactly. Like a Casio type of thing.
Super simple. Yeah.
And I think he made these releases almost exclusively with those sounds, in addition to like, you know, like a Skype ping type of bling, like sound effect.
And then so I'm really drawn to like the corporate music side of Vaporwave. Was he like one of the first ones to do that, or was there like whispers of that
before? I would say that like that like music-y stock department music store inspired kind of like side of Vaporwave. I think that really traces back to like Farside Virtual and Condo Pets. I think just because it was not shoegazy, it was very like crisp and bright and not that spacious sounding. It was like very in your face with how like polished it was or like artificial.
Yeah, that sounds like it sounds good. I've never listened to his work, but someone whose work I actually have listened to is Vectroid, who's the next musician that you listed. So
this is also like where my knowledge starts to come in here, like all this pre-proto vaporwave stuff I have nothing, but this is, and I think our listeners will recognize too, like this is the vaporwave album cover. This is like Macintosh plus
the definitive right at the peak of the genre's trajectory.
Even more so than any of the individual songs on this album, you'll recognize the image. It's this pink album cover with a Greek New Media bus to the left. There's a checkerboard floor.
Yeah.
And then there's like an image of a sunset or something, but
it's like a sunset over New York City with the Twin Towers.
Oh, nostalgic.
Whoa. Yeah.
So this you've definitely seen it on YouTube. It's like a recommended album that comes up on the side, you know. I've actually seen it for years and I've never clicked on it.
It's like one of those things, it's too obvious, like you don't want to give in, you know, you don't want to click it. Yeah.
But I actually like did listen to Vaporwave music for this week, although I've listened to it in the past as well. And I realized that I know songs from this album because they must have been clipped on like Instagram Reels or TikToks or other places. So like we're actually going to play like part of that now maybe for the episode. Do you have anything to say about the song?
Lisa Frank.
About Floral Shop?
So, yeah, the kind of hit off of Floral Shop was the computing of Lisa Frank 420. And it samples It's Your Move by Diana Ross. It slows the sample down, chops it up.
Yeah, something I realized listening to Vaporwave music this week is that, yes, there are lyrics, but they're repeated in a way that doesn't make them feel like they have meaning. So it's kind of an inversion of the purpose of lyrics. It's sort of like what Andy Warhol did in the 80s by repeating the same image over and over again to see how many times you could listen to it or look at it without it losing meaning.
It's kind of like working a word back until it becomes just a syllable or just like an element.
There is a big, just kind of like playing with semiotics, playing with meaning until just fall, or signifiers until they just fall apart and lose their function. I think, like what Andy Warhol was doing like in the 60s, it's always been kind of like this postmodernist technique, probably even has parallels in like the work of like Derrida. But were these artists really consciously trying to have these conceptual functions in their work? Maybe not. Maybe to some degree, it was like kind of like a formalist thing where they just kind of liked the sound of like, you know, things being off and things being like repetitive
askew,
and choppy.
Uncanny, I guess.
Yeah. Artists, as you know, as someone who went to SASU, both went to the same school. You can always retrospectively say it has more meaning than you intended. You can make it up. Like, you do that all the time.
That's so true. And I think that these artists would not reject or try to say, no, I was not trying to do that. I think they would welcome these kinds of interpretations of their work.
Mm-hmm. In these like collaborative online music things, I think there is much more of a culture of, sample my work, interpret my work. It's a little more free flowing than I think the conventional cutthroat music world of like, please give me credit, please give me money, that kind of thing. There's a little bit more love of the game, I think.
Yeah. So we just discussed these musicians, Ford and Lopatin, James Ferraro and Vectroid. The three of them put out albums before the term vaporwave existed, it seems like. It came a bit after all of this.
So I remember hearing in an interview with another kind of early vaporwave artist, Luxury Elite, she was talking about how at the time when these things were popping up online and coming to fruition, like early 2010s, there wasn't really an actual name for this genre. And she mentioned that people were even calling it something as unoriginal or not that thoughtful, like late night lo-fi is what they called.
You gotta cut it. It's like too long.
LNLF. You never heard of it.
the classic genre.
But so that's how it came to be. And then I just want to touch on this briefly. So the aesthetics, I always assumed that like the aesthetics were informing the music, which I'm sure there was a back and forth relationship. But for C-Punk, it was very much the case that like the imagery came first, the looks came first. With this, it seems like because it had its origins with Echo Gems and these other albums, people heard the music first and then they figured out the imagery. And I don't know how correct this is, but like I really do think that like the composition of vaporwave art does seem to have been derived a lot from Kevin Heckart. So as we think about that, we're now going to go into the next section, which is just like vaporwave aesthetics and imagery. Mm-hmm. So you wrote, Joseph, about early 3D graphics.
Yeah, I think this is one of the more charming parts of vaporwave imagery. I've had a rough interest in 3D modeling just from like getting a degree in mechanical engineering, and I had a lot of fun doing CAD stuff. early 3D graphics are funny to me because they required so much like talent of these people, like developing the tools that they were using. They had to be programmers and artists. And you can tell in the early bits, they were much better programmers than they were artists.
Yeah.
Basically. But it took so much labor and so much rendering time too. And it would come out looking like bad to our eyes now. I'm sure it was very impressive back then. But like the standard for 3D graphics has just jumped leaps and bounds, where it's like seeing these 3D images is just funny to us now.
Yeah, I saw a 3D graphic on Instagram today. It probably was from Pokemon Snap, but it was of like Pikachu dancing, and then a Lapras comes onto shore, and it's literally not, it doesn't blink, it's flippers don't move. Yeah. It's just like literally just moving left
just gets
right.
Scaled in, just gets like it's on a fixed track or something. Yeah. I took a 3D animation class in high school just to fill out my schedule. And it was run by this really weird older teacher, and he didn't have any money for software, so he used a software called Miku Miku Dance, which is where you would make anime girls dance. And that was I was in a state of disbelief the entire class. I was gonna be graded on how well I can make this anime.
Wait, that
girl
wasn't
dance.
The whole like year or semester, was
no,
it?
No, we found like other tools later in that, but he was building the curriculum as he went. But yeah, at one point, this is when Microsoft Kinects were a thing, you know, the motion camera. He's like, look what I got set up, you guys. And he brought a Kinect camera. And then I volunteered to get up and move around, and that would make an anime girl move on the screen. It was the most bizarre experience.
Imagine being his boss and being like, you're teaching them how to make girls dance. Yeah.
It was in the class.
That could have gone so wrong. Yeah. Like, if just the wrong kid with his mind in the gutter just like got up and, you know, did something really vulgar.
Yeah.
Like, damn. Exactly. I felt like such an idiot.
Yeah. I was like the only senior in that class. I mean, it was a lot of like weird anime kids. I went to a very nerdy high school. Mm-hmm. And so, like, there was just a lot of weeaboos and stuff in the class. And I had this like friend in the class. All we did was just express like how insane the situation is. Like, it felt like it was like a void in the rest of my high school experience. It was like, all right, time to go to anime girl class. Like, and none of my other friends were in there. So it just felt like this like delusion I would enter for 55 minutes.
Did your nerdy school have kids who'd go to the school during the summer to play Yu-Gi-Oh?
No. Mine did. No, that's interesting.
They couldn't even find another third place.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to say. They're just like, I don't know, what places are there? School?
Because there would always be
they can't go to a McDonald's?
It would always be the jocks in the school during the summer, and then they'd notice the Yu-Gi-Oh kids and be like, lurking what the heck?
That's really funny.
Yeah. You're a bit of a fan of Yu-Gi-Oh.
I mean, I liked Yu-Gi-Oh when I was like in kindergarten, but I had no idea how to play the actual
same.
Game.
No. You posted something 2 days ago of like a sexy Yu-Gi-Oh.
Oh, that I just found on Twitter.
No, but you vibe with it.
It speaks to you.
It's hard, yeah. I mean,
image goes hard. Look.
I think I put like an MIA song behind it.
Bamboo Banga?
No, Boys.
Oh yeah, that one's good too.
Yeah.
I like MIA.
I wasn't allowed to watch Yu-Gi-Oh! As a very young kid. My parents thought it was violent. I also just think it's a lot to take in visually as like a middle-aged parent. You know, just think the hair, for one thing. Yeah. And the whole setup is strange. They saw Yu-Gi-Oh! And Pokemon as exactly as violent as each other. And that's like,
with me as a kid, it was like I was allowed to like Pokemon and Digimon. But then by the time Yu-Gi-Oh! Came out, my parents were like, no, this was all a bad idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my mom tried to keep me off all that stuff until my cousin gave me a Game Boy Color with Pokemon in it, and I couldn't reject a gift. So then the floodgates were open there to to Japanese consumerist children. Yeah. Intellectual properties.
I couldn't watch Dragon Ball Z, and that was like actually violent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think, the Yu-Gi-Oh! And Pokemon, it was just so like, you know, choppy and like flashy that it felt like violence without actually being violence.
Yeah.
The next element of vaporwave that actually isn't really vaporwave. So I do see in a lot of vaporwave art dolphins, and this just seems like a sort of vestigial element from sea punk art. I do see the dolphins more often being pink or silver, whereas in sea punk it would have been like blue more often than not. But I do think this is just like people looking at sea punk work when they're first starting to figure out vaporwave is, not really getting it, starting to make their own vaporwave art right away and getting it slightly wrong. But what do you think?
I mean, I would, when you talk about like these like kind of airbrushy, kind of like shiny metallic dolphins, what comes to mind for me is like in the late 90s and early 2000s, like trance music, like compilations, like trance or dance hits, like Volume 7, like, I don't know, like all, or like Dream Trance, I think was a name of some compilations that had dolphins on like the album cover. I think that like some like C-Punk and Vaporwave people, when they, you know, were putting like dolphin imagery on their cover artwork, I think what they were kind of referencing, either consciously or subconsciously, were these old trance compilations that had these like cheesy dolphin graphics on them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Like cheesy dolphin illustrations. I mean, even the Echo Jams tape by Lopatin had a trance song, like Castles in the Sky by Ian Vendahl.
Do you, either of you, want to do the next one?
Greek New Media shit.
Okay, thank you for saying that, Joseph, because I can't say the S word, I don't swear. So we talked about this with C-Punk. So there's this term, Greek New Media S word. I didn't say that last time because I don't swear, but it's important that you know what it is, because you're not going to actually be able to find anything if you just look up Greek New Media. You need that extra word, because there's this website / blog that like it compiled a lot of early uses of Greek New Media. And I'm going to link it in the show notes as well. It's good to look at. So there's a long history of different cultural movements using Greco-Roman things. But I think that they can lean either Greco or Roman. Do you think that the way that like Vaporwave art used Greek New Media S word, do you think that it was more Greek or more Roman? What's your opinion?
Well, on the Macintosh Plus album cover for Floral Shop, it was a bust of
Helios.
So that's Greek.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was a little more Greek because, I don't know, maybe if you had like, I can't remember like a lot of Vaporwave art having imagery of like Roman emperors. I feel like kind of like fascistic like vibe coming from that.
Something that when things want to look back at, you know, when they want to do neoclassical things, they have to choose Greek or Roman. And I think the choice comes down to like, are you about art or are you about power? Is basically when people look back to Greece, they see democracy, art, poetry, all those things. Look back to Rome, they think like war, coliseums, people fighting lions, wearing, you know, chainmail and sandals and stuff like that. So I think it's like there's such a like a just non-militaristic thing in Vaporwave, of course. It's a very like, you know, happy-go-lucky kind of thing. I think they're just going to find the kind of like, I don't know, Greeks are always a little friendlier. They seem like less harmful than the Roman symbology.
Yeah.
Probably. Well, I
even as we've discussed gay sex, the Greeks were a lot, it was better under the Greeks.
Yeah. So like with the Greek New Media stuff, like Roman bus columns, you know, these art and architectural features, I noticed that like they also figured to some degree in like 80s interior design, like
columns and pediments and stuff.
Like just some concrete examples, there was some Italo Disco album cover or single that it was like Tim Hooker Atlantis, and he's like posing with an illustration of a Greek column, or he's like leaning against it. And then I saw another photo of like Don Johnson in, you know, Miami Vice. He's in this like super pastel-y neon living room, and there's like a bust, like a Greek bust right next to him. You know, it's like, kind of a zeitgeisty thing in the 80s that people were referencing with Vaporwave art. Even like dance clubs, like discotheques in Europe had this kind of like neon plus neoclassical look to them.
And there was also a new classicism in the 80s with the Harold Washington Library being a famous example. But in the architectural community, this was sort of the most recent renewed interest in neoclassicism. Mm-hmm. And I actually really like neoclassicism. I think that it was a bit derided at the time, but I think it's the last moment I think I can kind of see detail before we get into like all of these glass skyscrapers, which are nice sometimes, but I prefer detail in architecture. Yeah.
It's like the first mid-century modernists, like they saw themselves working in the classical tradition, but in a very abstracted way in terms of things were orderly and symmetrical. That's how they saw classicism. And then when it came to like 90s postmodernism, it was in a much more like beat it over your head kind of way of like, we have a Greek column. Like that is why it's classical.
Well, I mean, like the whole thing of postmodernism was like irreverence to some degree, or like like a tongue-in-cheekness. So like they were trying to create like these really sometimes ugly pastiches of like the hyper-modern and the very ancient, like a skyscraper that looks like a castle type of thing.
Or walking downtown in the Loop yesterday, I pointed out the parking garage that looks like the front grille of a car. But like of a 1920s car, it was built in the 90s, and it's just so on the nose. It's always described like anything. It's like it's a place you put your cars, but it's shaped like a car. Isn't that funny? And it's like I guess, but it still it does have like some levity and some fun to it. So the next thing you see in a lot of like vaporwave stuff is Japanese text. Yeah, you guys want to take that over?
Yeah. So with Japanese text, this is something that the appropriation of languages or writing systems that you don't speak. This isn't something you see with prior like mass indie Tumblr genres like C-Punk and Witch House. This is the first time you first start to see it. And it's very popular. You see it across other like niche internet subcultures. But it actually came from, it started for a good reason because it was, vaporwave was a critique of the 80s. And there was this like fear during the 80s that Japan would supplant the US as being the world superpower. Yeah. And you see this in media during the 80s, like with Blade Runner, how they depict LA as this futuristic place, but there's a lot of people speaking Asian languages and there's a lot of billboards with Asian text.
Well, yeah, I think with Blade Runner in specific, it was like, the idea was like all these people from, I'm pretty sure it was Japan specifically, coming across the Pacific all the way to Los Angeles and just settling there. And yeah, with the whole fear in the 80s that Japan's economy would surpass that of the US, much how today Westerners fear this about China.
Japan in the 80s was like hugely ascendant, you know, like we didn't know if there was going to be a ceiling to that at all. It was very reasonable to think they would overtake us. They ended up having a huge recession in the 90s, like much worse than anything we experienced in the US. It really brought things down a peg. But it was just in that moment, like people were getting their business cards. They have it on English on one side and Japanese on the other. Like it was just an assumed thing of like, oh, the Japanese are coming. I think in a lot of 80s content I've watched, it's like, oh, the Japanese investors are coming in. Like that's always a big topic, is like meeting with Japanese
people. But it was the Americans that were like responsible for all these mergers and acquisitions and bankrupted like all of these like 100-year-old companies. Like they did that to themselves.
I always thought it was funny in with the whole WeWork scandal, like, you know, basically he got all these investors to really believe in the promises of his company that he was going to revolutionize the way that we work and also become maybe one of the largest landlords in the world. And one of his biggest investors was this Japanese guy. And it felt like such a retro storyline for like a deep-pocketed Japanese investor. And he was a really old guy too, a guy in his 80s, who means that he would have been an active, you know, investor in the 1980s. But like we still have those kind of, I don't know, relationships.
But I do feel like the use of kanji and the Japanese writing system on a lot of the album cover artwork and even in the song titles. I mean, I think that some of these vaporwave artists are like, you know, weeaboos, otakus, and they just liked having this little thing they could tie to their love of Japan. But I mean, yeah, I think that it's still valid to interpret the use of Japanese text as
a symbol of globalization.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think that the use of Japanese or other foreign texts over American cultural products. Like when you see a poster for an American movie, but it has no Roman alphabet text on it, it's just kanji or another writing system foreign to the West. It has the effect of really foregrounding or highlighting that this cultural product isn't really just a piece of culture. It's a commodity and it's destined for exchange on a global market.
Things can be like almost too easily translated. We would think that like I was reading an article about like Netflix, you know, how they go to all these different countries and they just set up their own production things and they imagine like, all right, we'll just make a product here and we'll sell it to the people, and they have all these surprise crossover hits. And now they almost try and cultivate these now, but it's very like tricky to do. Basically, like you never know what's going to be that crossover hit. Why was Squid Game so big? Like it's like lightning in a bottle kind of thing.
And so Japanese text to me now is like a very big red flag, but conceptually it makes so much sense why it was popular with Vaporwave album covers and in Vaporwave art. I do think that there's this strange connection, though, where now into the present day, you know, Vaporwave is past its peak. It's not like dead, but like it's been past it for a while now. But pre-pandemic and then into the pandemic, I would still see guys who seem to have like a dark suburbia vibe slash a Zendemic vibe wearing long sleeve shirts that would have Japanese text along the sleeve. It was always a sign to me that they like doing drugs, and it just had this like flavor of downward mobility. And there's a lot of things going on. But like,
are you familiar with this term, dark suburbia?
I mean, I could figure out what it means.
The suburb you're from is not a dark suburbia suburb. You're from like forest where people are well adjusted.
Yeah, you're from like a legacy suburb where old houses and stuff like that. It's there's something about like a sunbelt sadness to like, you know, kids in stucco boxes with parents who make good money and still get into drugs. Yeah. That kind of thing.
No, a dark suburbia suburb is Naperville, aka Naperthrill. That's where the guys there, they just like, there's nothing to do. You just drive around, and then you drive around drunk or on drugs because, like, why not? And then you total your car, and then it crashes. Anyway.
But do your parents pay for it?
Yes. I would say that is, yeah, that's a part of the dark suburbia thing, yeah. What's it called? The show with Zendaya, which is escaping me, right? Euphoria. Oh, my God. Euphoria is the ultimate, like, California-flavored dark suburbia kind of thing.
Yeah, I tried watching a little bit of that show. It was just, like...
Beats me up, man.
It was like a panic attack for an hour. It was really, really.
I was just like,
dark.
I didn't know you're allowed to show that on television. Was my first thought on the first episode.
Well, and it's then, HBO, right?
Yeah, I guess, but like, I don't know. It felt like it was showing more than I'd seen on like Game of Thrones in terms of
for sure.
Crassness.
One more thing on the dark suburbia stuff. So, a song that I think encapsulates this like, it's not a vaporwave song really. It's more of like a mumble rap song, but. It's Flossing by Six Dogs, and I think that its use of Japanese text with just like a stumbling semi-attractive man with like anime in the music video, it just like, it's an example of how all of this stuff is synthesized. And the YouTube channel that like this music video was uploaded to, first couple of characters are in Japanese, but then the rest of it is Astari, and they use the psychic energy logo from Pokemon. That whole channel is just filled with like all of these examples of like how rap, mumble rap started to kind of fuse with vaporwave imagery to a degree. And I'm not part of this world, but it exists and it's important to bring up.
I am not part of this world either, but I feel
Thank goodness.
I feel like, you know, Young Lean was never really vaporwave. Like when he came out, people were calling his stuff cloud rap, and which I don't know if like Gang or whatever.
You can credit him as the origin of that for sure.
I think so, but I don't know if they want to be associated with that term anymore. I just don't pay attention to Drain Gang.
Doesn't he make folk music now?
He might. I mean, he's Swedish, right?
Yeah, he still has the face tattoos though. I thought Young Lean was cute until the like not. I mean, cute as a concept, basically.
No, you meant cute.
I haven't told I look like him. But, like, he's just like a northern year. He's from Sweden. Like, how can you be nihilistic and sad? I mean, other than the fact that weather's bad. Yeah, that would make me pretty grim. But, like, they have such a high standard of living. And here he is, like, going out, getting addicted to drugs and getting face tattoos.
Yeah. I mean, he must have had a reason. My favorite Young Lean moment is this interview that I think Vice did with him, where it was after the founder of IKEA died. And they're interviewing him and they're like, oh, like, do you want to talk about how the founder of IKEA died? And he's like, oh, no, that's personal. I'm so sad about it.
Ingvar Kamprad is his name.
Oh, yeah. Man. No, he seems sweet. I actually am a fan of Young Lean personally.
Yeah, I think he's a sensitive boy. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to like trash Young Lean. I tried to get into some of his earlier stuff and I was like, well, you know, there's not much really drawing me to it. It's not much making me want to keep listening, but I don't really listen to a lot of, you know, modern trap drill. I don't know. That's totally foreign to what I normally listen to, and I have nothing against it. It's just I'm not wired to appreciate that stuff. I think.
No, me neither. I don't like when guys rap. I like when women do it a lot, like I love Azealia Banks, but
oh my God.
Yeah.
I mean, like, Azalea Banks and like Nicki Minaj are just comedians when they make music. I mean, half of it is just like they're saying the most like crude things and it's really funny and they do it.
But
like,
it sounds amazing. Personally, like I don't hold women to the same standard I do to men in terms of like, I love when they talk about having sex.
But when men do it, it's crude.
No, that's not like
it's ungentlemanly.
I don't want to hear about you. Like, personally, I really don't like Leonardo DiCaprio because of his body count.
And, yeah. When he was part of the whatever their gang was back in the 90s, how they just the get rat, the brat pack,
no. Rat pack. Yeah. It's the Brat, yeah. Or no, maybe, no, it was Brat Pack, because Rat Pack was like Sinatra. And
it's like, yeah, they just went around, it was the 90s, so they're just wearing like crew necks and suit jackets and just getting very laid, I guess was the general idea of it. I'm a big fan of Rico Nasty. I don't know why. There's something about it, like, it doesn't overlap with any of my other music tastes and stuff, but she's from Las Vegas, I heard, so, you know.
Wait, Rico is a girl?
Yes.
Rico, okay, Nasty. Cool. The next thing we'll talk about with vaporwave art is Japanese fine art. So when you look at vaporwave art, oftentimes you'll see prints from the ukiyo-e tradition, the floating world tradition, where, you know, hundreds of years ago, Japanese printmakers would make prints that were very complex and high quality, but relatively affordable, so they could be purchased by Japan's burgeoning middle class. And so you'll see like references or direct appropriations of the Great Wave of Kanagawa by Hakusai, or depictions of Mount Fuji from Hiroshige's 36 Views of Mount Fuji. And to me, these don't really blend in that well. And I realized while like thinking about vaporwave art that the 3D busts or the 3D Roman columns kind of fit in, because we see those across time periods already. Whereas like 2D art, when it's added into something, it just doesn't match as well.
Yeah.
To be honest, I don't really, maybe it's a more recent kind of development to in vaporwave to include this traditional Japanese art and or art from this period in Japan in on like covers and stuff, but I think that there's something about that seems a bit out of place. I think I just don't remember seeing that too much.
Yeah, I think it's a misappropriation. I realized during
it's a little too
this
literal.
Week's episode that the there's nose, sort man. Of like two layers of vaporwave where there's the like bisexual purple synth wave Simpsons stuff where there's like the formulaic, easy to sell, easy to consume. Yeah. Like you start to listen to vaporwave and you get the formula. And that's where I see this like traditional Japanese fine art. But then there's also what you were doing more so and what the people who created vaporwave were doing, where they were thinking about concepts and there's this higher level community of vaporwave artists who are responding to each other and challenging each other to be the avant-garde.
Yeah, I mean, I think in relation to like dark suburbia and that whole world, I think that it's important to kind of make a distinction between the fact that the people that were the progenitors of vaporwave were not really, maybe they grew up in the suburbs, but when they were like really active as vaporwave artists, they were, you know, living in cities like Ford and Lopatin were living in some like apartment in Brooklyn that didn't even have like hot water when they made on That We Can Play. So it was like they were like the urban hipsters who were kind of at the vanguard of culture putting this together. And then, you know, over the course of the 2010s, it kind of went from these urban epicenters through the internet, because it was a very online thing, to the suburbs and maybe even like rural areas that just had internet access and some people kind of plugged into what was going on. And I think that, Tumblr was a big website to spread vaporwave music and art, net art. But I think that when this happened, when like people who were not in on vaporwave from the beginning started to get into it and didn't really know what they was just like, oh, it's this cool new trendy internet thing. And I think it's cool because it's online and it's trendy. And I think that the progenitors of vaporwave were kind of turned off by this because to them, vaporwave was very much like an inside joke. There was a, even if there were like a con- conceptual framework that was kind of deep to what they were doing, it was still pretty tongue-in-cheek. So when someone, say you have an inside joke that you've been riffing off with your close-knit group of friends for a while, and then someone new comes along and they try to butt in on the joke and try to rehash it, it's just not the same. They don't get where it's coming from and it falls flat. It's not funny. So by the time, like, you know, nerdy suburban kids got to Vaporwave, the people who had, you know, started it thought that, like, the joke wasn't funny anymore.
Yeah. Some people always say, like, if you can properly, like, apply a name to a movement, it's probably already dead.
Exactly. You know?
Like, and yeah. So, and that's always, like, not to be mean to the suburbs and stuff, but I will be mean to the suburbs. Like, by the time it gets there, it's dead. You know, like, yeah. if it's outside of those environments, if it can be easily packaged up and sold to people with no connection to the ideas of it, then that means it's already become, like, overexposed in some way.
Yeah, and I feel like Reddit was a big, like, once it got on Reddit, and, like, all the nerdy people on Reddit were, like, really, like, hyped up about it. I feel like that was the final nail in the coffin, even more than Tumblr could ever do.
Yeah, Reddit's not a good way to grow any culture. People just, I think they have a very, like, I think they want to solve things on there. They want to, like, arrive at, they want to make rules. They want to, like, decide what is and isn't. Yeah, it's just this very nerd approach to, like, anything. So by the time it gets there, like, it's just too far gone.
All the subtlety is just lost.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and this, what you mentioned about it being largely popularized by the suburbs is a good segue into the next element of Vaporwave art, so cityscape. So oftentimes, usually when you look at Vaporwave imagery, cities are depicted in the distance. Many times there's a car, there's the idea of the commute or the drive, and cities are represented oftentimes too in Vaporwave art at the center, where, like, you're in it, but it's usually in the distance. And I do think that that's not a coincidence, where the people getting excited about Vaporwave and making Vaporwave art, they were arriving at it and they were, like, they didn't have urban experience and they felt more comfortable depicting Vaporwave experiences being like driving in your car. Like, Residence by Home, the way I originally found it was a YouTube video of Bart Simpson with four of his friends and they were driving and the song was for like 2 hours or something. Yeah. And I listened to that.
Well, that's also like a subgenre is Outrun.
Yes, that
I can call that.
I would say Outrun is like, it's more like a synthwave subgenre because it's more on, it's not as sample based. It's like, you know, people writing their own synth lines and stuff, but it has that very like synthy, you know, like
driving beat basically.
Yeah. I won't get into like the technicalities of like what kind of synthesizers they want to emulate, but you know, it has that kind of like 80s like action movie, horror movie kind of vibe.
Yeah.
And another way that I think we can connect like ideas of urbanism to Vaporwave is just the later popularity of city pop, which I found originally in the same way that I found Resonance by Home with that Bart Simpson's video, where it was originally I saw Plastic Love as a recommended video with millions of views, and it kept being recommended to me, and eventually I listened to it. And I haven't been the biggest consumer of city pop, but it's definitely been like almost as popular as Vaporwave has been. Like, I teach art classes for Foundation in Chicago to youth, and they, like, every term I make and I add to this like very big playlist, and usually that, like, usually a few students recommend city pop songs for us to listen to as a class. And so it's still like very popular.
Well, there's a kind of offshoot subgenre of Vaporwave called Future Funk, which is like not as slowed down or as roomy. Well, maybe kind of roomy, but it's much more upbeat, and a lot of it actually will sample city pop or like Japanese funk or jazz, like smooth jazz, whatever, and put like a house beat under it and kind of speed it up. And I think that maybe city pop around the dawn of future funk in like the mid 2010s, it kind of seemed like a segue or like a way to like take the what was going on in Japan during the 80s and like make a new genre out of it, make it relevant in a vaporwave context. And, you know, it was just like fodder for inspiration and to sample.
And on Vapor Raven Cities, one thing I did want to ask you is last week we did a Yuppies episode. What's your take on Yuppies?
I mean, I think they still exist, of course. I did listen to a bit of the Yuppies episode, and I think that, you know, the young urban professional is just, it's still a thing. I feel especially in like the world of like gay men, it's so prevalent. Like everyone is
like
just
professional gay man, like that type.
Yeah,
of,
I mean, like everyone's just very like concerned with being like upwardly mobile and
working,
you know,
consulting
like,
or something.
I don't know. They like having some office job or like even in like research, just anything that like pays well. Like, you know, the Puerto Vallarta gays, just like, like, I mean, everyone who went to Puerto Vallarta that, you know, wasn't like in their 50s or 40s, basically they're a yuppie, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, the straight yuppie community is thriving. Joseph and I yesterday went to the St. Patrick's Day River Dying. We didn't see the parade. That's less cool than the River Dying, honestly.
Yeah.
But yeah, thousands and thousands of yuppies flocked to our city to celebrate it.
Yeah, no, people
well, if
from
they
like,
flocked to the city, then are they really yuppies? Are they living here? Well, or are they just in the
like
suburbs?
People who lived here.
Like, I met a girl who was like from Indianapolis, you know, and she was like, they people come downtown to like see the River Dying and all that.
Yeah. I've heard though that like our city, Chicago, we kind of go hardest for St. Patrick's Day. I believe it.
Yeah.
I think we just have that culture. It's like Big Ten schools. They're really into it. Yeah.
I'm curious about Boston and New York cities. I mean, they don't have a river they can die. I mean, they have a body of water, but they don't go about dying it.
Yeah.
But I just feel like Chicago is more.
My roommate this morning actually brought up how there's a city in Florida that dyes the river green. It was like, I don't even know which one, but
The next thing I want to talk about is like vaporwave and how it relates to like advertising and capitalist aesthetics and like the march of technology. I don't know. I don't know much to say about like late stage capitalism other than the fact that like I believe in the term. I think we are in some kind of late stage of that. But it feels like, you know, vaporwave is like sardonically critical of capitalism in the way that it kind of twists it around and uses corporate jingles and like trades and corporate aesthetics. But I think it's yearning for a time where like corporate control existed, but it was a lot more benign, and technology existed, but it wasn't like in every single aspect of our lives. You know, the computer was still in the computer room. You know, it was safe. It was contained. It wasn't in our pocket and controlling our thoughts. So many of the trends we live in now had already started, like, you know, in the 70s and the 80s. That's when corporatism, I think, truly took over in America. But
I
think
with Reagan.
Yeah, like with Reagan and all that. And so I think if vaporwave is looking back to the past, looking forward, it's a retrofuturist aesthetic. It's kind of like saying like, all right, if I was in 1988, what would I think the future would look like? Everything would be Japanese, like, you know, dolphins everywhere, all that kind of stuff. And even like, I think Apple's a good example of this, of like in the 80s, they were just seen as like a cute, quirky, creative computer company. And now they're just like, they've literally landed a spaceship in California, essentially in the form of their like headquarters. Like they're just this global behemoth.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever mentioned this to you, but I feel apprehensive and uncomfortable buying products from companies that I don't feel like would hire me. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, I guess I could work for Apple retail, but Apple corporate is so selective and elitist in its hiring practices. It's like, no, I don't want to support you. And that's actually an example of a company that I can't really avoid. I do buy from them. Yeah. I have an Apple laptop in my lap. Mm-hmm. But I successfully avoid other companies that are like that.
I have a quick bit. I don't know how I want to like phrase this thing, but I think that what we're looking for when we in the retrofuturist aesthetics of vaporwave is that like it was one of the last times it felt like there was an American dream in a sense. People always talk, oh, is the American dream alive or dead or something? But I think that just like the promises of modernism, like I was reading about this idea of hauntology, which like Derrida, the philosopher, would talk about this a lot, of just like sometimes a culture will have a dream denied, basically a future they think they're owed. And as the gap between the lived experience and the promised future grows, like we need to make increasingly more complicated stories in order to like explain that to ourselves and explain our condition. And I think that in pre-9/11, like, you know, technological world, like, you know, we're gearing up for this future where like, you know, it's not in the 1950s anymore. Maybe we're shrinking our goals. Maybe we're not always going to have that house in the suburbs or something. And it feels like anything is possible around the corner. Things are going to keep improving. And then this is also 1992 was that book, The End of History, where like the author argues that like we're never going to see large scale wars again. It's all going to be small little conflicts done in very organized ways. Like we're just going to see like the end of these large climactic shifts. Like things are achieving a certain kind of stasis. And everyone really believed that until 9/11. And they're just like, no, actually, like, yeah, throw that book out. Like, history is being made every day. Like, there still will be large shifts, like, in power structures in the world.
That really is the neoliberal mindset, though. It's like, we live in the end state of society. We just need to tweak. We just need to tweak things. Like, very imaginative dreams or visions about the world we could live in are not taken seriously by them. No. Like, we're going to have capitalism, and it can be, like, moderately left or moderately right.
Yeah.
And there's just some tweaking to do, but that's it.
Mm-hmm. That's what I said. I think that, like, the gap between the counterculture and the mainstream in the 60s is not as large as we kind of look back and see it. I think they both kind of had similar goals. They just, hippies had a bigger tent of who gets to be included in prosperity and all that. And they disagreed with, you know, the capitalist forces that would bring prosperity and all that. But I think now, I don't know where we are in comparison to that. I think it definitely feels like we agree on less. But
yeah.
Vaporwave clothing?
Yeah, so vaporwave clothing is next. So the first outfit I personally think of when I think of vaporwave, when I think of a vaporwave outfit, is just like the profile picture of the Facebook page. I don't know the first Japanese part, but it's like Japanese text YOLO, and it's of this guy. And the Facebook page has millions of followers. Like, a lot of listeners probably are familiar with him. But his Facebook account is like a vaporwave archive. But in his profile picture, he's just wearing like what is a very mid outfit, but you can definitely tell is his best outfit. Like, I see this with people in public all the time where like you can just tell like they're dressed
up. It's their one.
Even though it's very mid. And so he's just wearing like a denim vest and a hat. And yeah, but I think it's actually is representative of the average vaporwave consumer. They, as we'll get to in a bit, were very anonymous. And the musicians and the consumers both, like, they don't really dress up. There are vaporwave clothes that you can buy, but, like, overall, people were very dressed down.
Well, yeah. I mean, I feel like the aesthetic or, like, these, like, Japanese text on the sleeves type clothing, I feel like, or, like, Vapor 95, whatever that brand.
Yeah.
I feel like that stuff was, like, very, like, ex post facto, like, after... Yeah. Like, everyone thought that vaporwave was, like, irrelevant, and, like, it was, like, a big thing in, like, suburbia, and, whatever.
You described the album Floral Shop as being, like, a midpoint, or, like a...
So,
like
2011 is...
I would say, like, 2011, 2012 was its peak in underground culture.
Yeah.
Like,
and then it peaked in mainstream culture, and then it, like, it gets passed around.
Yeah. It's kind of weird how things work like that, but I remember, like, back in 2015, people were like, hey, didn't that whole vaporwave thing die, like, a couple years ago?
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, you watch, like, videos about, like, vaporwave's history, and a big topic that always comes up is vaporwave dead?
You're gonna find this crazy, but according to Google Trends, the actual peak of vaporwave was in 2017. That was when it was its most popular. So, like,
I can
that was like that. What, like 5 years after Floral Shop came out?
Yeah, I would say there's two peaks. I would say there's an underground peak and there's a mainstream peak. I would say 2011 for the first one, 2017 for the.
Yeah, like how I described there's two levels of vaporwave. So, the higher level one came earlier, and then the like bisexual purple mid vaporwave stuff that like peaked in 2017, I guess.
Mm-hmm. But no, because I think if people really wanted to try to, like, people just want to buy t-shirts. So people want to buy a visually identifiable, this is a vaporwave t-shirt, has Japanese text and dolphins on it. It's a lot harder to actually, like, build a, like, 80s futurist aesthetic. I would say the way you're dressed, Peter, like, is pretty 80s. Kangol hat, like, swishy pants.
Kangol has more 90s, I think.
Maybe you're right. But yeah, it's like, but that's a lot harder. Like, assembling an outfit that, like, references like clothing people wore then and materials that were new and exciting and like profiles that were big. That asks a lot of the consumer, and the consumer does not want anything asked of them. It's, I think, the lesson.
But C-Punks were able to do it. Like,
well, C-Punk was like a club kid thing.
Yeah.
I mean, like, club kids in like,
but for me, Chicago, but for me as a C-Punk, I understood the mission that I needed to wear C-Punk, that I needed to wear swimsuits to school.
Yeah.
So, but
that water aesthetic. Yeah.
But yeah, there were plenty of like online brands that offered vaporwave t-shirts at, you know, pretty affordable prices. Like it was something that you could just buy a shirt and like wear your regular pants. And like that was enough to like go out in public and people would be like, oh, vaporwave. You didn't need to like be this like stellar dressed up person. You could just wear the shirt and then people got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was, I think, because it did catch off so much with like, you know, like dark suburbia, like some straight guy who's really nerdy, chronically online, and like doesn't even think about fashion, and is just like, oh, this is like kind of fashion-ish. Like this is cool for clothes, so yeah. I'll just put this like Japanese like jazz cup, like solo cup, on, and like people think I'm like really tapped in.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, like with vaporwave fashion, I think the fashion was like an ex post, like an after the fact thing.
It's like, I guess we should have a fashion style. It's like we have music here. I guess we should put together.
The thing is, like around like 2011, what was kind of like a, you know, in like the urban hipster stuff, there was a lot of like, you know, like you could go to Top Man. Like I remember in 2013, like the Top Man store on Michigan Avenue had like the whole floor was just like all of these like kind of like slim cut, like not Hawaiian shirts because they were slim cut, but like, you know, these like button yes. down shirts that like had these like really like geometric, crazy like public bus seat or like Chuck E. Cheese carpet kind of designs on
them. I would say those are one of the three like designated shirts you can wear as a Zoomer at a music festival, is like the retro sports jersey, crazy floral shirt, and then like a more conventional Hawaiian shirt, I would say.
Yeah.
Those are your only options as a guy. Yeah.
Yeah. And this, I think, is a good way to circle back to just the word aesthetic. I've already given my take on that, you know, that it's a, like when you call something aesthetic, it's a quick way to signal that you as like,
it speaks to
a digital native, it still has an impact. It's not boring. But you, both of you wrote different things on the docket about the word aesthetic.
So the freewheeling use of it kind of annoyed me when it started, like, because I was just very into the study of aesthetics kind of in a way. I don't know, maybe that was just me having a big head as I was a kid. But just people just saying aesthetic, I'm like, aesthetic and? Like, and what? Like, what do you see in it? Is there something in its form? Is there something in its, like, the emotions it's conveying to you through that? Like, I was just like, I wanted more from people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I mean, of course, it, like someone says aesthetic, it's like, what aesthetic? Like,
which one?
Yeah.
In college, you tended to prefer using the term netty as opposed to aesthetic.
Oh, well, that was because like...
Never heard of this.
Oh, that was a friend of mine actually kind of came up with the term like netty. Like, it's very netty, like to signify that something had a lot of like net art influences or had a very online look. But I mean, around, you know, Tumblr, early 2010s, like I think the word aesthetic was kind of like a jokey word where it was like, oh, aesthetic.
Like, in that tone. Yeah.
It was like,
so I hated when it was spaced out. That was always like, no, this is.
To look like Unicode.
Oh, space. Oh, like that.
The spaces between each sweater.
But I mean, at that time, there was like on Tumblr, just the punchline of every joke was just the word internet. You know, like the joke is just like internet. That's the joke. Like, it was kind of the same thing with aesthetic. Like people just being like the jokes were just so like upfront and very Zoomery, where it's like, you know, it's not even like the punchline is the joke and there's nothing more to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One thing I meant to bring up earlier that I wanted to circle back to now is just how I think vaporwave is generally very male. Mm-hmm. And when I was thinking about clothing for vaporwave, you know, it's just like a guy who's wearing shorts or pants and just needs a shirt to throw on. And I think it's largely because vaporwave is such an anonymous genre. People don't like to show face. And guys generally don't like to show face because they think they're less cute than they truly are. I don't think guys are as fugly as they want to think. But yeah, it's... Yeah, they just feel more comfortable in this space.
You know, I think that something that just came to my mind is that maybe the reason why vaporwave is so, or even a lot of electronic music is so faceless.
Yeah.
Like, not just because it's guy dominated, it's because it's instrumental. The only real time when you want to like show yourself off as an artist is if you're actually singing. You yourself are actually singing.
You're performing.
In the music that you're putting out. If you're not singing in the music, then what's the point of putting yourself on the album
cover? You'd have to dance in the music video, and you don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's why there were no vaporwave producers really like putting themselves in the music videos, because they would have to dance. No one likes doing that. If you're
Or they can just kind of like sway around despondently. I guess you can do that too.
Yeah, like Six Dogs and Flossing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There you go. Yeah. And then, I mean, you do have Young Lean kind of turning himself into a key part of his music and everything. But again, more cloud rap.
But that's why he got more famous than all these other people.
Yeah, because you could put some
into it.
And
he
had vocals, yeah. So
to get attention.
Sing, yeah. No, that's something.
Okay, so we're going to start to wrap up and like think about vaporwave as a bigger idea. And one of the things I want to touch on really quick is how vaporwave sort of outdid all of its peers. So C-Punk, Hellsgoth, Blockhead, and Normcore. I did a Google Trends comparison. I'll link it in the show notes. And you can see very clearly that vaporwave had the biggest peak and sustained it. Normcore and C-Punk, they had like significant noticeable peaks, but they did not sustain that for a period of time. Whereas vaporwave, it hit its peak and it stayed there for like 2 or 3 years. And so I think part of the reason why vaporwave outperformed all of the other like internet genres that were part of mass indie is just because it appealed more to normies and straight guys. So C-Punk, Normcore, Hellsgoth, Blockhead, these are things that appeal to the girls and gays who are alt. There's only so many of them. Vaporwave really took off when it became like this consumable product that like everyone felt comfortable consuming because it was made by anonymous people, and you could be an anonymous consumer and play it in your car or wear it on a shirt. And you could have this like very healthy relationship with it without having to go over the top and start like tattooing stuff on your body or dyeing your hair. Yeah.
Yeah. But like the fact that Vaporwave did reach this like visual supremacy as like, you know, an internet aesthetic that kind of was head and shoulders above the other ones in terms of engagement and Googling and like that kind of stuff. I think it's just because it has a low visual barrier to entry. As we've talked about the kind of t-shirt thing, I think that like the final funnel for something to enter the mainstream is how t-shirtified it can be, you know? I mean, everything must be like flattened and accepted and fit onto like that size. Like that's like the final form. Like I think so much of America can be told through its t-shirts, basically. And yeah. I'm someone who like tries not to wear t-shirts, of course. But I don't know, because I think it's just like, it's too easy. It's so limiting in that way. But yeah, like Hellsgoth never took over. Blockhead recently coined. And those are two very sporty things. I think you need to be in shape in order to pull off those.
What is Blockhead? I forgot to look it up.
Yeah, so Blockhead is like, this is coined by the hosts of Nymphed Alumni, which is like a fashion.
Alexi specifically.
Yeah.
Alexi.
So it's when a girl dresses in a way that's very like sporty and coquettish would be the thing. So tennis skirts, like what else?
There's a picture of Kristen Stewart that came out like last week, I think, where she's wearing like high heels, leg warmers with like Nike on them.
No,
and, like
think,
a sporty top.
Yeah,
I think it was
feminine and
she
sporty.
Had like Chanel socks on.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That had the like Chanel word on it.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And Blockhead has a British twinge to it. So it's like a girl in a rugby shirt, too.
Okay.
Like, stuff
or
like
soccer.
That. Yeah, or soccer aesthetics as well, like kind of internationalist sort of thing. It can be done in a more American way, and that's more broquette, they said. Yeah, and so that's like 2000s girls wearing like a fraternity sweater or something like that, like a more American football take on I'm sporty, young, and cute.
Yeah.
Kind of deal, but yeah. Zoned out there. Sorry about that. Just trying to think what else I could.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So yeah, to wrap up, the main place I hear vaporwave music in 2024 is on TikTok. The accounts that play vaporwave songs usually also play Crystal Castle, Funk, and the song Snowfall by One Heart. Because I'm an urbanist, I get recommended a lot of like Chinese urbanist TikTok accounts like CityViews 888 that use those songs, especially Residence by Home, which I played at the beginning of this episode. And so they post these like really gorgeous videos of ultra-dense Chinese megacities where all the skyscrapers have LED lights. And I think that the reason why they're still using vaporwave music in 2024 is because the futurism, the like sort of utopianism of this like 1980s, they're using that to sort of suggest that China has reached it, where China, you know, it has really like done something miraculous by becoming so like ultra dense and building these beautiful skylines. And yeah, I think that's why it's still being used in that way. It's because it evokes those feelings and it's now like the physical manifestation of it.
Yeah, it just seems like the music that makes the most sense for it to kind of like, yeah, wrap up that 80s skyscraper, like the future denied kind of thing we're talking about of like, you know, what is next for America? It feels like since I've been watching those videos that they're building the cities we thought we would be building, you know? Like you look at the progress of American cities in the 60s and 70s, building taller and taller buildings, and then just for Asia to shoot ahead of us in all of those things in terms of urbanness. Like they were more urban than, as we got distracted by the car, they like never fell for it. Basically, yeah. They just built high-speed rail and the tallest buildings you've ever seen.
Yeah, like I am very impressed with Chinese urbanism, but like there are things that people don't really realize are inconvenient. Like you have to go through metal detectors at like subway stations and high-speed rail stations. Mm-hmm. And like their high-speed rail is usually built not in the center of the city. Like in Europe, it's usually on the outside, like similar to where airports are for U.S. cities. So
that sucks.
There are things that like aren't as ideal.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you look at like the Gulf states, I mean, how like they've just copied the suburban model of development and they've just gone full like car and everything. And they achieve prosperity in a similar timeline as China, but China had the kind of like forward thinkingness to be like, no, let's do this the way that people used to build cities, but just accelerated essentially.
Yeah.
And then so the survival of vaporwave nowadays, I think the pandemic figures into this definitely. Like I feel like it's put a damper on this aesthetic.
I think maybe part of that could have been that, you know, people were spending so much time online during the pandemic that it just, like, vaporwave did exhaust itself at that point. Like, it had been an online thing for like a decade. And then by that point, people were just like looking at it so much, it just accelerated itself into the grave.
Yeah, I think that internet aesthetics are fun when there is a large differential between your internet life and your real life. You know, like they become like an interesting, quirky thing. They talked about this on InFed Alumni of how they're very like personally exhausted by the like internet girl aesthetic, which is girls who will post like an anime drawing of like a girl like on a computer. And they're like, this is me. I am the internet. Like I'm so plugged in and all that. And they just find that very boring. I think I do too, because it's like we all know we're like addicted to our phones. Like we live a half online, half offline existence. Me. And so I think that's why we hit me. Literally
I hate
me.
That.
But
people should be fined for saying it me.
And so I think that like that's why people chase aesthetics like cottagecore and stuff like the most, these ones that people see as being very offline, even if the only way you can engage with them is through online spaces. You can't go to a cottagecore meetup in real life, you know.
There are e-girl meetups at Catholic churches though.
Really? Yeah. Like trad e-girl, like that
variant? This image that's referred to as the e-girl summit, where it's just like a bunch of e-girls in a Catholic church on their genuflecting, you know, they're kneeling with their with their palms together. It's very beautiful.
And they're all in tennis skirts. They're all in American Apparel tennis skirts. Yeah. All the images generated in the whole vaporwave period, it's really insane. You think of, like those things actually require some amount of labor to do. There were those like vaporwave text generators. You just type something in and it would give you these like on a grid background with like neon mountains. You'd then have neon like font in front. And I don't know, I imagine now with AI image generators and stuff, there's just going to be a lot lower quality and more of this imagery. And it's not going to have that human touch of stuff.
Yeah, I think that vaporwave, because it was so popular for so long, every pursuable path has been pursued. And we have this mass of images that can just be fed into AI generators. And there's not really a reason to like make vaporwave art now. I think music, yes, for sure. But like just like the formulaic like grid plus Greek statue plus yeah. mountain plus city in the background. It's like, you don't need to have a computer.
We're
do
good.
That.
We did it already. We've made all the images. Yeah. And that's why I like in your Tumblr, just it's like sourcing of actual 80s period images. And it's just a smaller pool. I'm always fascinated how those images even end up online. Cause that means that at some point someone scanned that periodical or something. Yeah. And it makes you think about like how much else is like out there, like how many like interior design magazines from the 80s that never got scanned, and I could like bring that into the digital world. You know?
I met someone once who did that. I think they have, they still have the account. I believe it's called Baby Aspirin. It's on Instagram. But they told me that like every single image they upload, they found in print. Mm. Yeah, there are people that are still doing that.
Yeah, I follow a Lost J. Crew, which is just someone scans like J. Crew magazines from the 80s and 90s, and they're really good. But yeah.
Any other places we still see Vaporwave in the present day?
No, I can't think of any.
Okay. Well, one final one where I see it is, or I saw it, is I actually went to a wedding this summer with a girl that I went to both middle school and high school with, which you'd assume there's a lot of those, but there's only one. And I got invited to her wedding. It made me feel happy. And she had a bit of a Vaporwave theme to the wedding. It wasn't like visible all the time, but like the groom's haircut, it was a bit of like an 80s mullet to a degree. And then there were guests who were like matching the theme better than I was, where like they had like an 80s sports club jacket. And then something that the couple did for everyone was they made a cassette tape for every single person. So you sat down at the table and there was like this Vaporwave cassette tape, and it was, they just said nice things about me for like a minute.
Oh, that's what's on there. It wasn't music or anything?
No, I think the backside was, the B-side was music or maybe, one of the two.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it was fun.
That's just so interesting. Like, and that was a year ago?
Yeah, it was in August.
How plainly did they phrase it? Like, please come dressed Vaporwave?
Well, actually the invitation was very Vaporwave too. It was like, there was a mountain as well. But yeah, that wedding was fun, but it was like, sometimes you really get like put in place when you're reminded about like how far some suburbs are. Like, I think the reception was in like Lincolnshire or something like that. But yeah, they had the like wedding in a chapel in Andersonville, and then the reception, then there was something we had to do in like Skokie, and then we had to go to Lincolnshire. It was a lot. It was a lot.
It's very built around cars. Yeah.
Yeah. I had to take a metro to the wedding. But yeah, thank you for taking Metro to do this episode with us, Peter.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Check out Drew's music. You have it on SoundCloud?
Yes, it is on SoundCloud, Bandcamp, maybe some streaming services.
Yeah, we'll link it in the show notes. But yeah, thanks for sharing your experience with Vaporwave with us, and we hope you have a good day.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, you too.
Bye.
See you.